in the KSRO kitchen. Oh, what a perfect time to meet up with Chef John Ash. Welcome, everybody, into the kitchen.
Well, good morning to you.
How are you?
Good.
This morning, fine and dandy?
On this beautiful morning. It really is a beautiful morning.
You never know that 48 hours, 72 hours, what type of commotion there
and
was.
And the power's back on.
Yeah. Did you lose power?
No, I didn't. You know, but everybody around me, a block away from me, they lost it, and my daughter lost it for a couple of days, and it's like, it's crazy.
But, you know, PG&E says, wait, this is Chef John Ash. Uh-huh. He might be using his appliances.
I didn't think about that.
And they said, let's skip him.
One of those things. Do you know who I am? You better not turn off
my power. It's no rhyme or reason, as you know. Down Farmer's Lane, one whole side of Farmer's Lane was functioning just beautifully. The other was completely gone.
Yeah.
So to try to figure out the grid system, I think, is just a losing proposition.
Well, one of the things that we don't want to get into it too deeply, because I don't know what I'm talking about, but that idea of having smaller grids would make sense, you know.
I think so.
Anyway.
Well, good. That was a good observation. But thanks to all of our listeners for joining us this morning. Unfortunately, we ended up having to throw out a lot of food. Mm. We didn't have enough dry ice, and I'm sure many folks had the same experience as us, and we kind of start from scratch and rebuild and try to be better, a little better prepared.
So let me ask you, have you thought about getting a generator?
I have. A number of our neighbors have invested in generators. The pros and cons, the installation costs and all of this have been a little prohibited yet, but I haven't really delved into it deeply as of yet.
Yeah, there are a lot out there. And the other thing that I didn't know, I thought, well, maybe I'll get solar. But having solar doesn't answer the problem, because you're on the grid still.
That's correct.
The grid shuts down, then you still don't have any power.
That is correct. And I learned about that this week at a seminar I attended. But if I even have a generator that could keep the freezer refrigerator going, and that wouldn't take a whole lot, and I don't care if I'm in the dark the rest of the time, as long as I don't end up losing all that food, I might consider doing something like that on a small scale. Yeah. If anybody else has some innovative ideas, email Steve at ksro.com. Yeah. A couple of my neighbors had four or five ice chests, and they were proactive, and they had purchased dry ice. And actually, a friend of mine, whose wife works for a huge pharmaceutical company in the Bay Area, they have lots of dry ice because in the pharmaceutical business.
Yeah.
And so he was able to access a lot of it, because it's not inexpensive.
Yeah.
So he was in good shape. But I think better sooner than later to be a little more proactive.
Yeah.
Well, you had a wonderful article in the Press Democrat this past Wednesday called Magical Mushrooms.
I know.
Magical Mushrooms.
But there was a subtitle to that.
There is, and it's so funny, because I was looking back in our mushroom file, and do you know it was 1999 that our Good Food Hour 12th Annual Listener Recipe Contest was mushrooms. So a 20th anniversary on all these great mushroom recipes that we received. And I was still looking back at some of the innovative mushroom recipes we received. And I think maybe we'll even post a couple of those.
Yeah.
Since we're going to post a couple of your mushroom recipes on our website today for people to look at. So I loved your commentary on the mushrooms. They are intoxicating, they're enigmatic, they're deadly, they're delicious, they're mysterious. And you went on and on and on about the wonderful world of mushrooms. And a lot of the history was fascinating, too, before we even get into the mushroom recipes themselves. But we have, as you mentioned, a wild culinary history here in Sonoma County of foraging for mushrooms.
For a long, long time, it's kind of going on. And it's still, you know, I think all of those mushroom hunters out there are waiting for that first rain, you know, for them to pop up. And one of the other things, you know, common sense, it's made all the time, but if you don't know what you're doing, don't go out and gather mushrooms. And I included in this article a comment about, if you want to learn more, if you still feel you want to go out and forage for mushrooms, go call the Sonoma County Mycological Society. They have classes and wonderful people, and in January have a wild mushroom camp that you can go to and hang out with people who really know what they're doing.
And that website's www.sonomamushrooms.org, and that's a great place to start to find out about foraging for mushrooms. We were blessed to be able to attend a lot of the Mendocino Mushroom Festival activities some 20 plus years ago, riding through the redwoods on the skunk train to the camp and
Wasn't
going out
best
and foraging.
Time?
That's where my mushroom mushroom education really began back in Mendocino for many years. And I know you were obviously you were part of that and taught at that camp for many, many years. Mm-hmm. Have you been able to go out foraging in the past few years? I know you used to.
You know, not much. You know, and again, I guess I've scared myself with this thing, because the deeper you go into it, I mean, even things that are that we think we can recognize all of the time, wild like chanterelles or black trumpets, well, they have lookalikes that, if not deadly, could make you pretty sick. And it's like, oh, I don't want it. I'll just buy them from somebody who knows what they're doing.
For example, gourmet mushrooms, which you reference in the article. And we started, well, I know you at the restaurant were one of the earliest purchasers of gourmet mushrooms, probably back in the late, mid to late 80s. Because they started in the late 70s, Malcolm Clark and David Law. I'm not quite sure when they began selling at retail. In the mid 90s, I think it was.
It was quite a while. And originally they just grew shiitake mushrooms. That was their primary mushroom. And then so many growers got into growing shiitake that they began to branch out and now have this whole wonderful line of exotic mushrooms of all kinds that that you can buy from them.
And I remember when we had talked with Malcolm many years ago, gourmet mushrooms was truly on the cutting edge. They were the first in America to grow these cultivated wild mushrooms in a lab setting. Pretty remarkable.
And he had a great interest and still has a great interest in what they call nutraceuticals. That is the pharmacological side of mushrooms that, for health. And there have been lots of studies done about using mushrooms. They've been used in Chinese medicine for forever, and they have a lot of apparently a lot of good things they can do for you.
So here's a multiple choice questionnaire. What is the largest organism on Earth? Is it A, a blue whale, or B, a mushroom?
Well, I know the answer.
it is a mushroom.
It is a mushroom, yeah.
That was revealed in your article. Yeah. I can't believe this.
It's up in Oregon, and it's covers, I don't know, how many?
You said 1,700 football fields.
Yeah.
4 square miles of turf?
Yeah. But it's all underneath, and they didn't know it for a long time, and then they began to do DNA studies of mushrooms in this big area, and it was like, oh, these are all from the same mushroom.
That's wild.
Yeah.
It's 2,300 acres of Oregon's Blue Mountain. That's a remarkable statistic. You're full of wonderful statistics.
I thought you were going to say you're full of it.
And you mentioned that the Japanese have confirmed that lightning strikes can more than double some mushroom crops, both in the wild and in cultivation. And getting back to gourmet mushrooms, they used to have a deal, didn't they, where mushrooms, you could buy a whole bunch on a certain day.
Fridays. They're called crop monster days, and they still do it. You should check, because they always used to send out a note. You could get on their email list and they would remind you, but I think it was Fridays from 1 to 3, and you had to buy them in the quantities that they package them in, which are kind of 3-pound quantities. But 3 pounds is not a lot, because there are a lot of things you can do besides using them fresh. You can dry them so that you have them later on. You can roast them and then freeze them. And so, you know, 3 pounds is not a lot.
Do you dry mushrooms? Have you dried them? Or do you use a electric dryer to do that? Or do you use it in a slow, low oven?
No, I don't do it in an oven, just because it's kind of problematical. So I have a dehydrator that I do with that. But it's you know, and you need to do something, because they're mostly water anyway. So you need to get that water out of there. But I think it's always interesting, and probably the greatest example of that are what we call porcini, and the French call ceps, and it's all the same mushroom. But when you get them fresh, they're delicious, and they have a very almost delicate flavor to them and all that. But the same mushroom sliced up and dehydrated, when it's dehydrated, it's mushroom, the intensity of the flavor of the mushroom, you know, is 10 times, 20 times more. And so a lot of cooks, you know, like the dry ones better than they like the fresh ones.
Do you rehydrate them? And or do you grind them into powder and
you
use them?
You can do both. That's an interesting question. If you're going to just cook them up and put them in a sauce or something like that. You need to rehydrate them first and then saute them. But you can also grind them up, and they make the most wonderful coating for, you know, fish or chicken or steak or any of that stuff. You know,
just like a mushroom powder with a few other seasonings.
Slap it on there.
That sounds good.
It's really great.
So cleaning mushrooms, that was your next part. Then storing mushrooms, which you've just covered. And then all these great mushroom recipes. The mushroom pate, which would porcini is the one you, I believe,
well,
used on this one.
Well, I used a lot of fresh mushrooms in there, but a little bit of porcini, again, because it has such an intense flavor.
Gosh, I've had this before. You've made this with the cashews.
Yeah.
Oh, that was wonderful.
And it's so easy.
And then marinated mushrooms, well, that's about as easy as it gets, doesn't it?
It is. They're so good.
Vinegar and a little garlic and sugar and salt. And then the maitake, hen of the woods tempura.
Maitake.
Tempura with ponzu dipping sauce. Does Gourmet Mushrooms sell those?
They sell maitake, is and it's my favorite one that they, it's also known as hen of the woods, and it and they cultivate, and it's absolutely delicious. It's great.
And what kind of oil do you use when you...
When you fry, well, you want to use, I won't give you the whole lecture here, but you want to use an oil that's clean, doesn't have any flavor associated with it, and that has a relatively high smoke point. So for most of us at home, the ones that fall into that category are canola oil or peanut oil or those kinds of things.
So we don't need an exotic mushroom, I mean oil for that.
No,
for
deep frying. No. And probably the best one of all, which used to be expensive and was kind of exotic, is grapeseed oil, which is really neutral. It has the highest smoke point of all. And it, again, it used to be expensive, but now you can buy it at Trader Joe's and at Costco and places like that.
I know that some local restaurant chefs like to use rice bran oil for at least their deep fried chicken.
Yeah, yeah.
That's
a good choice, too. It's a good one, too.
Mushroom soup with creme fraiche. Mm-hmm. That's another one. You use the dried porcini mushrooms in that one.
Anything that has mushrooms in it, I end up putting a little dried porcini in there. Just, again, because it intensifies the mushroom flavor.
Soft polenta with mixed mushrooms and mascarpone. Mm-hmm. This is an exotic one. Chawan mushi with black trumpet mushrooms.
Well, it's not so exotic if you're Japanese, because it's a classic kind of appetizer, first course thing. And basically, it's just a little egg custard that you put in a steamer. And if you want to go crazy, you can buy some chawan mushi cups, which are teacups with a lid on them, but you don't have to do that.
Oh, and the photos are beautiful. Yeah. Is it Kent Porter who took the photos?
No, that's John Burgess.
Oh, John Burgess took the photos for the PD. They're gorgeous. Are these your little teacups?
Yeah. But you can do it in a ramekin and just cover it either with plastic or foil and then put it in a steamer. And it's
gorgeous.
It's so delicious.
Beautiful presentation. And then the final one, well, of course, there has to be a dessert mushroom.
Yeah.
And that's the candy cap custard sauce for desserts. I first had that at the Mendocino Mushroom Festival 20 plus years ago. And dried candy caps you can use for those?
Yeah, you'll rarely, if ever, see them fresh unless you have a mushroom hunter friend. But again, it's another one of those that when it's dried, the flavor intensifies, and it's just the aroma of it. I mean, you have to keep them jarred. It's a beautiful aroma, but it smells like maple or maples or butterscotch or those kinds of things. So it makes a wonderful dessert sauce. And also this sauce is, it makes the best ice cream. So you can have mushroom ice cream.
I remember at the festival years ago, we had a candy cap bread pudding for dessert. That was just sensational.
Yeah.
So experiment with some of these.
Yeah.
And especially if you can get the deal at Gourmet Mushrooms.
Even if you can't,
you don't need a lot.
No, you don't. And they've expanded their retail sales dramatically, so you see it in a lot of local markets.
So mushrooms. What we'll do is we'll post a couple of these mushroom recipes this week on the KS Arto website. How about that?
That would be great.
We'll take a break. John informed me that October is National Seafood Month. So we will chat about seafood when we come back. And then at 11:35, we welcome special guest Sean Brock, who's admittedly one of the hottest chefs in America, both his restaurants and his cookbooks. And he has a new cookbook, which we'll chat about during the show. And one of you will win a copy of his new cookbook, just released actually this week, that will be mailed to a lucky KSRO Good Food Hour listener. Direct from the publisher. More after this.
Sonoma County's local news, weather, and traffic station, FM News Talk, KSRO, 103.5, 94.5.
Many wildfire victims don't know if they have a valid claim against PG&E. The team at Skegus Law in Santa Rosa wants you to know your rights before the claims deadline of October 21st. Clients come to Skegus Law with questions about the PG&E lawsuit, like, what does it mean that PG&E chose to file bankruptcy? Is this a class action case? How will this impact my insurance claim? Do I have a viable claim, and is pursuing a claim even worthwhile? How long will this take? We at Skegus Law are helping victims of the fires get the answers they need and the resolution they deserve. We would like you to know your rights in the PG&E bankruptcy process. If you're a survivor of the North Bay fires, please call Skegus Law at 757-7610 or visit skegus.com. That's 757-7610 or skikos.com.
This is George Adair with Cross Country Mortgage. If you're in the market to buy a home, this message is for you. My team and I are experts at providing hands-on assistance to getting your home financing done fast and with confidence. Folks, I've been helping people obtain the right financing for nearly two decades. This experience has helped hundreds of homeowners get through some challenging situations. Maybe you're a property investor, or how about a first-time home buyer? Divorces are very complicated, and you need my experience to understand what your mortgage options are. Inherited property or rent-to-own agreements are also my specialty. Financing a home is a huge transaction in your life. When combined with a challenging situation, you need the advice and confidence to do it right. If you're ready for a great lending experience, call 707-583-8100. That's 707-583-8100. Or visit georgiadair.com. That's georgiadair.com.
Cross Country Mortgage, NMLS ID 2039, and George Adair, NMLS ID 245370. Equal housing lender, subject to credit approval.
After the fires, rains, mudslides, and flooding these past years, the rebuilding has begun. We're drying out and turning the corner. To aid in our community's recovery, Hawley's Paint Store is offering contractor pricing on all Benjamin Moore paints and stains purchased in gallons and fives through the end of 2019. That's right, for the rest of the year. Come into Hawley's Paints, located on Santa Rosa Avenue between Todd and Hearn, for all your painting projects.
Here's a message from the Marin Sonoma Mosquito and Vector Control District.
Tick-borne diseases are preventable. Use an effective repellent and wear long pants and long-sleeve shirts when outdoors. Don't forget to check yourself, your family, and pets for ticks after outdoor activities.
Are you having a problem with rodents getting inside your home and don't know what to do? The Marin Sonoma Mosquito and Vector Control District offers free advice and home inspections.
Go to msmosquito.com for more info.
KSRO, AM, FM, and online. Depend on it.
Well, I bet you didn't know that it was National Seafood Month. I didn't know until you told
well,
me.
Well, get on. Come on. So get on it.
So I wanted to print out this chart for me. I know you know all this information, but for our listeners, too, it's put out by the CUESA, Ferry Plaza, Cultivating a Healthy Food System. And if you go to their website, you can print out the seafood availability chart. And this is seafood available at the Ferry Plaza Farmers Market in San Francisco. And it has the fishing seasons here in Northern California. And it does say that all the species are on Monterey Bay Aquarium Seafood Watch, mm-hmm. best choices or good alternatives, which is important.
Yes,
right?
It is.
And just going down the list, if we can, clams are year-round. Black cod is year-round. And that's where we go to John Ash's great article, Black Cod, the Best Fish You've Never Heard Of.
Mm-hmm.
Still.
Yeah.
Even though you did this wonderful article back in May
yes.
about black cod. And you did say that if there was only one fish to eat for the rest of your life, it wouldn't be salmon.
No.
It'd be this.
Absolutely. It's It's entirely sustainable. It's a little more difficult to catch. Like, it doesn't run in big schools often. They kind of are loners out there by themselves. But they range from Northern California all the way up to the Bristol Bay in Alaska. And it is the most delicious fish. And if you can't find it fresh, you can buy it frozen. And there's no difference. You can't tell the difference between fresh and frozen.
And it's not black, and it's not a cod.
And it's not a cod.
It's known as sable fish or butterfish,
yeah.
Because it's very silky and has a high fat content.
Yeah.
And is a very healthy fish,
gosh,
too.
Yeah.
Loaded with all those
and
good
omega-3s.
And
it's just, you know, it just cooked by itself. So the other thing that I love about it as a cook is you can't overcook it. Which, you know, can happen with so many other fish because of that high fat content. So even if it falls apart, doesn't matter. Still eat it.
You said overcooked. You mean like when I cooked my halibut a couple months ago and on the grill and it dried out and didn't do very well?
Well, that's the problem. Halibut is a difficult one, especially on the grill. I tell people, I think the best is to do it in a packet. I call them a hobo pack, you know, and you can take a piece of foil and put the fish in there with good olive oil and lemons and cherry tomatoes and capers and all of that kind of stuff, and then seal it up and then cook it that way. That way, even if you overcook it, it'll still stay moist.
Now I know.
Yeah.
Next time I buy halibut. One of the wonderful recipes you gave was this hot smoked black cod. I love that. And you use the stove top smoker for that, which is not too expensive and certainly looks
good. They're cheap. Well, you know, they're $20 or $30 or something like that.
And you do it on top of your gas or electric stove?
Yeah.
Is that what you're doing?
You just need good ventilation. You need a good fan because it does obviously give off smoke. But most of it stays in the little smoker itself, so it's not a big
issue. And the color is beautiful. It turns that nice orange color.
Yeah.
So black cod, worth investigating. And you can get that at some better fish markets around
town. You can get it at fish markets. You can actually get it at, again, places that are selling portioned, frozen, cut fish, you know, like even Safeway and
Trader Joe's or Costco, maybe.
And if they don't have it, ask for it, and they'll get it for you.
Okay. And some of the recipes you gave in this article was the black cod fritters, the hot smoked black cod, the black cod and asparagus salad with spicy lime dressing. There's also the kaffir lime and coconut soup with black cod. And I want to mention that right now on our KSRO Good Food Hour website, you can access John's black cod in a spicy coconut broth, which was a recipe you gave
delicious.
A while ago. Even if I say so myself. And that's a real good one, huh?
Yeah.
And easy for us to do?
Yes.
There's a little coconut milk and chicken stock. And you do use some laksa paste. Can you buy that pre-made?
The answer is yes, but you make it yourself and you make a big batch of it and it freezes wonderfully and it's the base for this curry that's there. You just need a blender to buzz it up in.
Okay.
So. And it's much better than, I've tried some commercial ones, and this is so much better.
Okay, so go to the website and make that and make your laksa paste, and you'll be a happy camper about that. And what else did you do on that black cod recipe packet that you put together? The lime juice one did sound good. And there's, miso marinated black cod, which has been around for a while.
That is a very famous recipe from Nobu, who kind of introduced it into America, and then as he expanded his restaurant empire in America, of course it was served at every one of those, and now I think most Japanese restaurants will serve it. And what it is to make a paste out of white miso and a couple of other little things that you do there, and you marinate it in there. He does it for 2 to 3 days, and then you take it and broil it, and it's like nothing you've ever had. And you can do it with other fish, too. You don't have to do it with black cod.
And that's, you get a lot of bang for your buck on that.
Yes, you do.
That recipe.
Yeah.
And then the final was a steamed black cod with garlic and ginger. Beautiful recipe. And speaking of good ways to make your halibut, prosciutto wrapped halibut with kale pesto. Don't grill it like Steve did, unless you want to do the hobo packs like John suggested.
Yeah.
And this is oven roasted.
Yeah.
Is that the way?
Yeah.
And it won't my halibut won't dry out that way.
No.
Does the prosciutto keep it moist?
It does, and it flavors it, and you know, because there's a little fat in the prosciutto, and plus that wonderful porky flavor that we all love.
You've sold me on that. So both of those recipes are on the website, the prosciutto wrapped halibut with the kale pesto and John's black cod in a spicy coconut broth. Make some this weekend.
Yeah.
How about that? Yeah. We'll take a break, and we'll chat with Chef Sean Brock after these messages. Steve Garner and Chef John Ash in the KSRO kitchen this morning. Want to thank all of our wonderful winemakers. Last week, it seems like it was years ago, doesn't it, that we were at the Harvest Festival out at the fairgrounds. All three of our sweepstakes award-winning winemakers, Mr. Beckman from Boletto with that sparkling rosé was wonderful, and Gio Ballesteros from Russian River Vineyards with that
Chardonnay.
Sensational Chardonnay. And I have not seen you as excited about Chardonnay in 20 years.
Can I tell you something? I went and bought a case. I liked it so much.
You did?
I never did
that.
No, I don't.
You don't. And then the marvelous Sangiovese Rosé from Alexander Vineyards. Terrific wines.
Yeah, it was great. You know, I think this year the winemakers and the wines that we had on the show were as good as we've ever had.
I agree. And also the terrific Jay Vineyards Pinot Noir, which won the best red wine.
Yeah.
And thanks to Bethany Bardsman from Out to Lunch Catering in Petaluma for bringing
it. Her food was great.
Her food was great.
Yeah.
And Cookie Take a Bite.
Yeah.
Tracy from Cookie Take a Bite, which is opening a retail cookie stand in the Larkfield Shopping Center at the end of October.
We'll Very exciting. Just in time for Christmas.
Perfect. Back after these messages.
Join the switch to crystal clear KSRO FM 103.5 Santa Rosa, Windsor, 94.5 Petaluma. Hear the difference.
Did you know the largest RV dealer in the North Bay is now celebrating 28 years in business, and they're right here in Petaluma? Reed's Trailer Sales on Old Redwood Highway in Petaluma has over 200 travel trailers, fifth wheels, and truck campers. Now's the time to make the best deals of the season, and Reed's will match any show deal on comparable models. Also, Reed's Trailer Sales is looking to consign your late model motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. Let our experts sell it for you. Reed's will get you top dollar and save you all the time and hassle, or they can pay you cash on the spot. The largest RV dealer with over 28 years in business is right in your own backyard. Reed's Trailer Sales in Petaluma. Call 792-9100 or on the web at reedsrv.com.
Reed's, Reed's, you should buy your trailer at Reed's. A fifth-wheel travel trailer or utility. You should buy your trailer at Reed's.
Reed's Trailer Sales.
Now accepting consignments.
Enjoy the fall harvest at the Santa Rosa Original Certified Farmers Market. The market has lots of winter vegetables, nuts, cheese, and meat from your favorite farmers and ranchers. The Beet Generation will be barrel roasting Romano beans and peppers. Aroma Floral from Petaluma has beautiful fall, pepper, and lavender wreaths. There are artisan foods ranging from fabulous bread, olive oils, marinades, tea blends, to seafood and pastas. Don't miss Saturday, October 26th, Harvest Festival and Day of the Dead celebration. There are pumpkins and sugar skulls for the kids to decorate, and place a photo of your lost loved one at the memorial altar. The Santa Rosa Original Certified Farmers Market open year-round Saturdays 8:30 till 1 at the Luther Burbank Center for the Arts. The Santa Rosa Original Certified Farmers Market, where it's always fresh, local, and fun.
Sarcoma. Odds are you've never heard that word before. For the 40 people diagnosed with sarcoma every day, it is a life-changing word. Because sarcoma is cancer. Through awareness, advocacy, and research, the Sarcoma Foundation of America is bringing hope to the families whose lives have been turned upside down by a cancer they had never heard of until diagnosis. Please join us in the fight to find the cure for sarcoma. For more information on the work of the Sarcoma Foundation of America, go to curesarcoma.org.
Healdsburg Lumber Company and Hudson Street Design serve contractors and homeowners in Northern California. Here's General Manager Jill Gaylor.
Hudson Street Design is staffed with experienced, highly trained professionals and offers the finest products in Sonoma County for windows, doors, finished hardware, skylights, cabinetry, window coverings, and plumbing fixtures. Choose Hudson Street Design.
Hudson Street Design, a Healdsburg Lumber Company. HudsonStreetDesign.com.
Thank you.
in the KS Arto kitchen. I'm Steve Garner, along with Chef John Ash, and want to welcome to the program Chef Sean Brock. Good morning, Sean. Nice to have you on the show this morning.
Oh, thanks for having me. Good morning.
Thank you. Are you speaking to us from Nashville this morning, or where are you?
I am in New York City.
Oh, New York City.
Wait, you're supposed to be in the South.
I know. Well, the book tour kicks off on Monday here.
The last
book tour kicked off here as well at the 92nd Street Y, so it's becoming a tradition.
The last time we chatted with Sean was in Santa Rosa back in 2014, where you were here doing an event at Spinster Sisters Restaurant.
Oh, yeah.
Remember that? And I swung by the restaurant, and we chatted for a bit, but unfortunately your chat and your dinner ran a little long, and you were unable to come back to the studio and chat with us, but we're catching up here now 5 years
here
later.
We are.
Well, congratulations on the first book. That was Heritage, and we have that in front of us, and it won all kinds of marvelous awards, Cookbook of the Year, etc. And I'm looking at our Best Cookbooks of the Year list, John, from 2014, and you have as number one Heritage by Sean Brock. You were able to dine at one of Sean's restaurants, weren't you, John?
Yeah, a few years ago in Charleston, I was able to come to Husk, which is such a wonderful restaurants, and Charleston is, and you make the point in this book about being such a beautiful city and culinarily rich.
Yeah, it sure is. What a special place.
The first book, would you say that focused more on low country cuisine, and perhaps this book is more towards your background growing up in the Appalachian part of the country?
Yeah, I would say the new book, South, is where I am now and the lessons learned and the things that I've learned through just exploring Southern food with an insane and intense curiosity. And I think that's what's neat about books is you can capture those little moments. And I realize that when I go back and look at Heritage, I look through the recipes and I read them and I read the essays. And then to look to where we are now and see all the things that we've learned and all the crops and animal breeds that were at risk of extinction back then and now they're plentiful. It's just really neat to see that work.
You know, one of the comments that you made in the beginning of the book is that Southern cuisine is a relatively young cuisine when you think about all the cuisines of the world. And the part that I was really fascinated with, which I'd never even thought about, was these kind of micro regions that exist in the South. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, and these things have kind of, I've always known that because I grew up in the Appalachian Mountains, and when I moved to Charleston to go to school when I was 18, culinary school, I would be in the kitchen talking to the cooks about the foods that I grew up with, and no one had heard of any of it. It was, might as well have been a foreign language. And so I would bring all these show-and-tell items back from my grandmother's house each time I would go home to Virginia and come back to Charleston. And that was the first moment where I realized how incredibly different those various regions of the South were. And so fast forward, I was 18 then. So, yeah, it's just each year I discover more and more micro-regions. And if you think about why a cuisine is what it is and how cuisines are formed, it's really a simple formula. And this is just what I believe and what I've discovered through being curious about Southern food, is the geography of the place obviously plays a huge role. What animal breeds and plant varietals can thrive there. But I think the major piece is how those animal breeds and varietals got there, the immigrants that brought them there, or the natives that had them there the whole time. And so if you can combine those things, if you can look at the geography of a place, the plants and animals that thrive there, the foodways that thrive there, and the cultural influences, I think that's the formula for cuisine.
Well, I'd love in the book also that you take that and take some dishes, some recipes that we think of as being classically Southern, And point out the differences, even though they're executed in many of these micro regions. And the couple that you riffed on quite a lot were cornbread and shrimp and grits.
Yeah, and each day, you know, I think about it, I discover more and more and more. And I've started to realize that you can go even further than a dish into the intricacies of how different the shrimp taste in each region, or how different the corn varietals taste in each region. And that just baffles me and helps me realize that I have a lifetime of work ahead of me to understand these things. But cornbread is a really great example. I mean, the reason that cornbread is such a staple is because in the South, wheat has never grown very well. And, you know, the Native Americans and their love of corn. And so you see, and once you start to go around, what I believe is like the DNA that exists within a culture, and it's these flavors get embedded in there that you're born into craving. Mm. And I think cornbread ends up being a great blank palate for that. Mm.
You even use cornbread crumbs in one of the dishes, the Southern Clams Casino.
Yeah.
Interesting riff.
Well, and you talk about this, which I'd never heard of. Well, I'm not from the South, so, you know, sometimes we get in, not we, but I hear these arguments about, well, should you put sugar in your cornbread or not, and all that kind of stuff. And you made the point, it's like, well, traditionally it wasn't, because the corn was, even though it's field corn, it had enough flavor on its own that you didn't need to put sugar in it. But one of the ones you included was, which I guess is from Nashville, the hot water cornbread. Can you talk about what that is?
So that one's really neat, because I think that's one of the earliest forms of cornbread before chemical leaveners were widely available or used, and it relies on the steam trapped in from the water in the porridge that you make first. And so you basically make polenta. You boil some water, and then you quickly stir in some cornmeal, and then some people add an egg, some people add sugar. You can add different things, some lard. You can take it any direction you want, but what's neat is that kind of cools, and it's so neat to realize that it's a polenta cake. It is, you know, and then you start to say, wow, those similarities exist all over the place, and each culture has these staples that are there to provide comfort. I just think that's so fascinating.
The other thing, and Steve and I talk about this, Steve is from the South, so this is his kind of food, and he's very knowledgeable about it, but is your use of fats. I think we in California think about, well, olive oil for everything, or maybe butter, but you have a whole section of the book that talks about, you know, rendered fats from animals and other things that we don't know anything about here.
Yeah, it's interesting, because when I was growing up in the 80s, that's when there was a huge scare. Everybody was scared of using bacon mm-hmm. and lard and animal fats. And so I didn't grow up with any of that. It wasn't until I started cooking professionally and doing research on food on a more intense level that I started to learn more about that. But now, being a chef and having operated a bunch of restaurants, it's the natural thing to do. If we get in a whole pig, when we butcher it, we have the fat left over and we find uses for it. When we get a whole cow in, we have lots of beef fat. And with each animal, the way that we produce the food and break it down and handle it with care, we end up having these things. And so they naturally kind of work their way into the recipes. And then I think they make them better.
Will you use olive oil in your restaurants if you can regionally source olive oil that's grown in the South? Or is the olive oil grown in that region?
One of the biggest fears I had when opening Huss back in 2010, when I realized that to truly understand Southern cooking, I had to only use Southern ingredients. I was like, uh-oh, no foie gras and no olive oil. No balsamic vinegar, what do you mean? And so what that did, that discipline, caused us to go out and find these tiny little growers that were experimenting with growing olives in the South. And then we did the research and realized that Thomas Jefferson grew tons of olives in the South. And that agriculturally it worked because if you have a blueberry farm, you can use the same equipment, and seasonally they work together. And so now there's amazing olive oil available from the South. It's kind of amazing.
The book is called South. Is it just being released this week, Sean?
Yes, Monday.
Brand new. Exciting. Sean Brock, South, Essential Recipes. This is the follow-up to his award-winning book, Heritage. Either one of them deserves a spot in your library. We'll take a short minute and a half break and be back with Chef Sean Brock, Steve Garner, and Chef John Ash in the Chaos Arto Kitchen, celebrating our 32nd year, bringing you the best in radio food talk.
Hello, Sonoma County. I'm Brett Musburger. Please join me for play-by-play of every Raiders game on FM News Talk Radio KSRO 103.5 and 94.5.
Join me, Chef John Ash, on a culinary cruise with Oceana Cruises in October 2020. This 9-day Adriatic Awakening cruise starts in Greece and ends with an overnight in beautiful Venice. While at sea, I'll join you at a welcome cocktail party, dinner, and teach you some hands-on cooking classes.
Don't miss your chance to take hands-on cooking classes with Chef John Ash. Great cabins still available. Go to the KSRO website and click events. KSRO 2020 Culinary Cruise.
DJ Sash and Glass is a full-service windows and glass family business that has served Sonoma County since 1960. DJ's makes it easy to replace your old, drafty, hard-to-open windows. Improve the look and value of your home with reliable, energy-efficient Milgard replacement windows. You don't have to worry about disposing of your old windows. DJ Sash and Glass makes it easy to get your home improvement project done. And shower doors and enclosures are just a phone call away at DJ Sash and Glass. DJ specializes in custom shower doors and custom mirrors for your new or replacement bathroom project. Call DJ Sash and Glass today for windows and your shower door replacement. Add a touch of class to your glass with DJ Sash and Glass. 2985 Wilgin Court. Call 546-7344 and online at djsglass.com.
In the Chaos Arto Kitchen, we're talking with Chef Sean Brock this morning, and we're celebrating the release of his new book, South, which will be coming out in about 48 hours, the updated book, brand new from his first cookbook award-winning book, Heritage. And we'll get into a few of the recipes in just a couple minutes, see what you can expect. But, John, I know you must talk about fried bologna, right?
Yeah. I saw that in there, and I thought, oh, is this? I didn't know what it was. But I grew up with it, too. My grandmother, I grew up in the mountains of Colorado. And it was poor people's food in a way. And it's also really delicious. And you have a recipe for making your own bologna, which I'm sure is much better than the stuff we buy in the market. But even the stuff in the market is great.
You should have seen me in Modena at Osteria Francescana trying to explain to the cooks what we do with bologna in the South. Like we fry it and we take squishy white bread and lettuce and mayonnaise.
Well, now some people would say, well, that's poor people food. Mm-hmm. What are you doing dabbling in that? You're a world famous James Beard award winning chef. And, you know, why are you putting that in your cookbook?
Well, I think the most delicious food comes from poverty. I think it comes from people who have this ability and craft to take humble ingredients and through masterfully learning from multiple generations can transform them into something really comforting and really soulful. And that's the kind of cooking that really fascinates me and inspires everything I do and every decision I make. It's, you know, you go to a soul food restaurant and eat a lima bean, and it's just so flavorful and so luxurious and soft. And to me, that's years and years and years and years and years of practice. And those are the kind of things that strive for. Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you make that point all the way through the book, which is great, is to introduce those who don't know about the real joys of Southern cooking and its diversity and all of that. Are you concerned at all that we might be losing it? I mean, I guess that's the reason for this book, is you don't want to see it getting lost.
Well, it really is a two-way street. I think I'm equally as excited about the future and what Southern food has in store and is capable of, what the possibilities are. And I'll always be, you know, a history nerd, and I'll always be inspired by tradition. And I think to keep the tradition alive and to show true respect for the history is you have to move it forward, and you have to keep it in the narrative, and you have to keep it as part of the conversation. And in order to do that, it has to be interesting. It has to be maybe just try to make it a little bit better, or make sure the ingredients tell a story, or a tiny bit of creativity. If you look at how Southern cuisines were formed, and if you look at that formula that we spoke about earlier, well, what does that mean today? Yeah. If we look at the immigrant populations mm-hmm. of different cities and then our current agricultural state, and if we jot all that down or put it into a pot, what's that look like? It's different everywhere, and that's just amazing.
I want to remind folks that people can hear Sean in an in-depth conversation with Corey Lee coming to San Francisco on November 9th, Saturday, at Omnivore Books. A great chance to meet Sean and also take a look at the book. And then if you're in the Santa Cruz area on Monday, November 11th, you'll be in conversation with Chef Tanya Holland at Cal Ranch Hay Barn. So put those on your calendar if you're in the Bay Area. We want to talk briefly about your new venture in Nashville. This is an incredibly ambitious restaurant and teaching facility and experiment. Would you talk about that, Sean?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where the more you talk about it, the crazier you realize it is. but it's this idea born from the desire to create a less stressful and a healthier place to work. And I believe that will also translate into a more pleasurable place to dine. If the team is happy and healthy, then that'll end up on the plate, and that'll end up in the hospitality in the dining room. And so we're taking this new and exciting approach to involving the world of wellness in operating a restaurant, because I've had the luxury of not being in the kitchen for the last year, and I've taken a much needed break, and I don't really want to go back to it the way it was when I left it. It's just not healthy, and we're not built to withstand that kind of stress every single day, 6 days a week, 15 hours a day. But I love cooking, and I love the restaurant business, so we're going to try and find a balance. It's fun because every decision we make for the restaurant starts with, well, how stressful is that?
So this is a completely different way of constructing a restaurant than the traditional way. You're looking not only to make great food, but also provide almost a Southern folk art museum of the history of Southern ingredients, how they're grown, a reverence for the ingredients. It will be a part of the restaurant experience.
Yes, Southern folk art is another obsession of mine because it reminds me so much of soul food and Southern cooking. It's artists who are using mud and mixing it with Coca-Cola to make brown and soot from the fireplace for black and pokeweed berries for red, and to create these beautiful images, these beautiful pieces of art that are truly touching out of essentially nothing. I think that's just, it fits the feel and it fits the journey.
When will this enterprise be opening, Sean?
Oh, dear. I could safely say we're shooting for May
of 2020.
Yeah, and as soon as you walk into the restaurant, you'll see a seed bank. And so I've been collecting seeds for a long time and have become the steward of my family's seeds. And I'm starting to work closely with some new seed savers and companies and universities to
Wonderful.
Stock up this Doomsday Southern Seed Bank.
So it's going to have a couple of restaurants and some other features. Do you have a working title for what's it going to be called?
So the restaurant downstairs will be focusing on the food where I grew up. But it'll be a Southern restaurant, and it's called Redbird. Mm-hmm. And upstairs will be, well, the restaurant downstairs, my biggest inspiration is Chez Panisse. And it's the way it has always approached food has just been an enormous inspiration for me, and I think the South deserves a Chez Panisse. And then upstairs will be a smaller, more intimate tasting menu-only restaurant called Audrey, which was my grandmother's name.
Mm. Wonderful. She was a strong inspiration, I know, in your early cooking. 30 minutes has flown by, Sean. We've just scratched the surface on your new book, South. Why don't you give us your favorite number today, Sean, between 1 and 12?
7.
Caller number 7 at 636-1350 will win, really, one of the first copies available anywhere in the country of Sean Brock's new book, South, Essential Recipes and New Explorations. I wish we had a full hour with you, and hopefully when you come out to the Bay Area again, make some time to come up mm-hmm. to Sonoma County and visit with us, Sean.
Yeah, absolutely. Sure appreciate you having me on today.
Nice having you on. Sean Brock, thanks
you.
Again. Bye-bye. Chef Sean Brock, caller number 7 at 636-1350. And a magnificent book. And either one, if you get either Heritage, the first book, or mm-hmm. South, you will understand Sean's philosophy.
Yeah. Well, this South is, it's kind of cooking of the people, I think. You know, Heritage had a lot of fancy, not fancy, but, you know, a little bit more elevated food in it. This one is so basic, you know, and it gives you that real flavor of what happens in homes and in the South. So.
And I want to mention that there are a lot of exotic ingredients that are really mail order ingredients mm-hmm. in the book South. But still, there's a number of recipes that can be done with ingredients available yeah. right here yeah, in our yeah, backyard. Yeah, yeah. So it's well worth having your library and giving an appreciation.
So what was your favorite recipe, do you think?
I would say the fried chicken. Mm-hmm. I we didn't get to talk about fried
yeah,
chicken.
I know.
I'm sorry.
But I know that's a half hour for you.
No, it's an hour. What was for you?
Oh, you know what? I loved where his talking about, which is something you're very familiar with, but we aren't here at all, catfish. And he had catfish in there 2 or 3 different ways, which
yeah.
sounded delicious.
So Sean Brock and South, a book you'll enjoy very much. Next week, John will enter the world of cider with a marvelous writer named Jason Wilson, and he's written a book called The Cider Revival. He spent 2 years mm-hmm. traversing America, going to the greatest cider producers, a lot of them in upstate New York.
And this is hard cider.
This is hard cider. And also spent time in Spain and Italy and Germany. And this book is a knockout. And he'll be in the KS Arto kitchen to talk hard cider mm-hmm. next Saturday. Thanks for listening. Clark Wolf at the table following these, well, just a message or so. Steve Garner, thanks so much for listening. Back next week.
Petaluma hears FM News Talk KSRO on Crystal Clear FM at 94.5.